I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Tetsuro Shigematsu joins me now. The award-winning broadcaster, performer, and writer will premiere his one-man show, Empire of the Sun, at The Culch. It begins Tuesday, the 6th of October, and has already been extended when the initial run had sold out. There are a lot of people awaiting the show. It's a poignant and humorous show, the immigrant story, and the conflicts that arise amidst a family of multiple generations is born on stage as Tetsuro attempts to reach out to his father. For most sons, reaching out to connect with a father is a lifelong effort, and for Tetsuro, it took on greater urgency as his father was dying. The multimedia experience will feature audio from interviews conducted with his father, as well as cinematography from film being shot on stage, as well as miniatures. I'll get Mr. Shigematsu to tell us the genesis of the show and the process of getting this all on stage. The show runs until Saturday, the 24th of October. For tickets, go to tickets.theculch.com. The website for more is at shiggy.com. Rice Paper Magazine once called him the voice of our Asian generation. The show is produced by the Vancouver Asian Canadian Theatre. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Tetsuro Shigematsu. Mr. Shigematsu, good morning.
Oh, good morning, Joe. Wow, no one's ever addressed me as Mr. Shigematsu. So, given the fact that this show is about my father, I guess it's apropos since I play him as well. So, call me anything you like.
Do they call you professor over at UBC?
You know, they do, in fact. I think that's only because undergrads don't fully appreciate the fact that I'm not, in fact, a full PhD. I'm still just a candidate, but I certainly don't dissuade them because I'll take what I can get.
Yeah, you worked an awful long time. Why not take the title, right?
Exactly. If people want to call me doctor, medical doctor, sir, sama, yeah, I'm certainly not going to look askance at any kind of honorific.
But the problem is, when you're, in an airplane or in a theater or a movie theater or something like that, and someone says, is there a doctor in the house? I wonder if you put your hand up.
I do, and invariably, the person having a heart attack ends up looking very disappointed. I can't save your life, but I can talk to you about continental critical theory. Yeah, are you interested in heteronormative constraints of gender expression? No? Okay, you just want a real doc. Fine.
So we're actually talking on in the evening, just the weekend before the show starts.
Mm-hmm.
It must be a busy time for you this time of week, I suppose.
Yeah. In fact, at this very moment, I was just loading a bunch of gear into the car, stuff that I'm not bringing to the tier because we... just stuff I'm bringing home, and now we're zooming off to some place, I don't know where, but yeah, it's been hectic. What's made it extra hectic, of course, is I often tell people, I've never received so many texts and emails in my entire life. That's partly because the show is about to open, mm-hmm. but that's also compounded by the fact that my father just died about, it seems like maybe 10 days ago. So a lot of condolences. And a lot of well-wishers, and strangely, it's just kind of an overwhelming time, and yet, I'm also grateful for the fact that if I didn't have this show, which is kind of a tribute to my father, not a tribute, that's actually the wrong word to use because that suggests some kind of hagiography. It's actually, mm-hmm. the show is about him, but it's also critical of him, but the fact that he just died, and now I am in the midst of launching this show. It's actually a strange but appropriate way to process my feelings and kind of to grieve through this situation. So I'm actually grateful to be so busy thinking about him during this time.
Yeah, I was going to ask just what the process of mourning has been like these past few days. I mean, it's less than a couple of weeks out of it, isn't that right?
Yeah, in fact, that's a really great question because the line between life and art has never been thinner for me. In fact, it disappears completely, I dare say. One of the questions I ask at the beginning of this performance piece is, I don't know if I'm going to be able to mourn my father properly because I haven't cried since I was a kid. But now that I'm exploring and performing all these different chapters in his life, I feel like performing him, summoning him, it's almost like a seance where I'm channeling my father's spirit and I'm feeling things with a level of intensity that I've never felt before. So I feel as if this show itself is breaking up the ice in my heart. And as for what happens when I perform in front of the audience, is anybody's guess. The most the team was able to prepare me for is by pre-setting a handkerchief in my back pocket in case I begin to lose it. Because once those floodgates open, I don't know what's going to happen. If I start to lose it and I can't get it back, then I don't know, maybe we'll need to give the audience their money back that night. But yeah, we're kind of halfway between theater and performance art, believe it or not, because it's I'm telling stories about my father's life, but at the same time, because he just died, it's also kind of unfolding in real time.
Yeah, and it must be, I mean, it magnifies whatever you're feeling, having to do it in front of an audience, I'm assuming.
Well, it's interesting that you say having to do it, because for me to examine myself in light of my father's death, one of the fears that I have is that, well, when on the day my father died, my whole family was there, my sisters cried, but I didn't. And my fear is that my interior might be this well-groomed golf course with just slight undulations. And so I feel like if I'm going to try to create a kind of earthquake or a geological event within myself, that's not something I can just do at home in front of the mirror. I mean, maybe that's something actors do. I don't know, because I've never been to acting school. And I guess the difference between this versus another evening at the theater is that my name really is Tetsuro. My dad just died, and now I'm going to take you through his life, and we're going to see what happens. So for me, it's so important to have the audience there. And I ask them, kind of like in the spirit of a seance, just keep an open mind. I'm going to open myself to you, and open yourself to me, and then maybe together we can summon a spirit that I haven't felt since I was a kid, because I was a kid the last time I cried.
Yeah. How much of the show did he know about before he died?
Because I'm doing this in the context of a PhD, then the ethics committee requires me to give him full disclosure. You know, as if I was just a playwright or a regular type of writer, You know, there's a saying that, great writing deserves, great writing entails great betrayal. And this is my artwork, this is my version, this is my story, and this is how I see things. But because I'm doing it, because this piece is the centerpiece of a PhD, the requirements of ethics requires full disclosure. So I have to ask my father's permission. I've been interviewing him for 2 years, and I've been putting off this conversation because if my father said, no way, I don't want you doing that. I don't want you telling my stories on stage, then basically my 4 years of study would have gone down the drain. So I was very nervous asking him. So one day I asked him, very recently, I said, Dad, did you ever stop and wonder, why is it I've been interviewing you all this time? He said, no. I said, well, Dad, it's because I want to share your stories with other people. And then he just had this look on his face. He's become blind with his type 2 diabetes and other kinds of illnesses, and his emotions are very apparent on his face. And he just had this look when I told him that other people want to see or interested in his stories. It was as if I was saying, Dad, these toenails are yours. Do you mind if I hold on to them? I might want to sell them on eBay. He was that mystified. He basically said, I can't imagine why anyone would have even the slightest interest in my life story. And I have to say, well, I'm sorry, Dad, I should apologize, but I know they will because I've actually shared a couple of your stories, and I can assure you that people are very interested in your memories of World War II, how you emigrated to from Japan to swinging London in the 60s when you were a voice in the BBC. People are, before coming to Canada, people are really interested in your story. And I said, do I have your permission to share your stories with the public, to publish your stories in journals, maybe even in book form? And usually my father takes about a good 2 or 3 minutes to answer any of my questions. Mm-hmm. But immediately he said, yes. And I said, Dad, I don't think you understood what I said. And he said, and I repeated the question. My mom translated in Japanese. He said, yes. And I said, why are you so enthusiastic about this? I thought you'd say no. And he said, because if you share my story, then maybe my life will have had some meaning. So it really struck me that my father was coming to the end of his life. His life didn't have much meaning. And so I realized that my whole endeavor here was actually, up till now, a very selfish one. I was looking to Dad. Look, before you die, Dad, give me the meaning of life. Within these stories, tell me a single story that will make it all fall together. Because even though I'm a grown man, I have kids of my own, I still feel like a kid. And I didn't want my dad to die without him telling me the meaning of life. But I had never expected that doing this piece about his life, it wasn't about him giving me the meaning of life. Maybe, in a sense, I was doing something for him, so that was something that was a big surprise to me.
So even if he just assumed that no audience would be interested in his life, do you think giving you the time to talk about his life was maybe just, in his way, connecting with you?
You know, that very well may be the case, because I'm 44 years old. My father was twice my age, and I can honestly say that prior to these recorded conversations, we never had a single heart-to-heart conversation. And we just didn't know how. That was the norm for us. But given the fact that we were both public radio broadcasters, the one thing we did understand was how to do the long-form interview. So I used my father's old microphone, and that was actually the bridge between us, both literally and figuratively. Me holding the microphone close to his mouth, that gave me an opportunity to touch him, because that was something that I never did either. And by doing these interviews, yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe him agreeing to these interviews and these conversations were his way of finally connecting with me before it was too late.
And I guess, in a way, at the end of one's life, is there's no better time, is there?
Yes and no. If anyone is out there thinking of interviewing their parents, their grandparents, the best time to do it is today, because I can tell you from experience, I started 2 years ago and it was fine, but towards the end, because his body was beginning to fall apart and because he was beginning to hallucinate, it became harder and harder and harder towards the end until it got to the point where I just had to stop out of mercy. So on one hand, when you see the end is coming, oh yeah, you need to start, because once you begin to die, and there's two forms of dying I've learned. There's dying and then there's active dying. The active dying is when it's happening within a matter of hours. But when you begin that slow descent within the dying process towards the end, yeah, don't have the regret of never having asked your loved ones all the questions you've been wanting to ask and to say all the things you wanted to say, but you just didn't have the courage.
And so what's it like now? Because I'm sure there are questions still that you'd like to have asked. How do you move forward from that?
It's funny, Joe. Just yesterday during rehearsal, because my father was such an important part of the research, whenever my collaborators, like Richard Wolff or Heidi Taylor, asked me a question about my dad, I just pulled up the phone instead of dialing him and said, "Dad, what's your favorite book?" Or, "What was the house like when we first moved to Canada?" He'd answer, I'd hang up. And just the other day, I had this impulse, "Oh, let me ask him." And of course, I thought, "Oh, wow, I can't ask him anymore. He's gone." So it's definitely, I'm still trying to bend my head around it. It's funny, I had the privilege of having my parents move in with me a few months before they died because I wanted my dad to die at home surrounded by family. And one of the questions I had in my mind was, because my father was getting weaker and weaker, I wasn't sure to what degree my kids perceived him as a fully sentient human being, because he didn't say very much, he didn't move very much. I thought, do you still see my dad as grandpa, or is he just a plant to you? And just the day before yesterday, my son came to me early in the morning, very sleepy, and he said, I had a dream about grandpa. And I just said, what happened? He said, I was surprised because grandpa was revived. Then what happened? I said, he said, we all had a big cuddle. And then I said, okay, how did you feel about that? And then he just looked at me and gave me a thumbs up. And, you know, ours was a really terse, unsentimental exchange. I didn't want to freak out on him, like, wait, oh my God, you saw grandpa. I guess it was just very, very low key. And I was grateful for that because, you know, I'm not sure if what happens after death, and I don't want to, you know, read too much into it, but I was just happy that my question was answered, that my kids saw my father as their grandfather, and that's how they'll remember him. And to me, in a way, Empire of the Sun was my way of saying, here's something for you to remember grandpa by, because they're getting to the age, they're 8 and 12, where they're starting to ask questions about who they are, where they come from, their identity. We're half Japanese, we're half Iranian. And once they started asking questions about grandpa, I didn't want to say, well, I don't know. So this was my one window of opportunity to get his stories down, both for my kids, for my nieces and nephews, but also for everyone else, because everyone who has seen just excerpts of this show, they just feel like, oh my God, I feel like I know your dad. So I'm happy that in that sense, he'll live on.
And he's with you as you prepare to mount the show, and I'm sure he'll be there with every performance. I understand that because of the multimedia elements in the show, we'll be able to hear some of these tapes. Is that right?
Absolutely. My father and I were both radio men, so I actually play archival clips from his time as a broadcaster for the BBC, and I have a conversation with him using my own segments when I hosted the Roundup on CBC Radio 1. So my father's voice comes into it, my voice comes into it, my sisters, you can hear them playing themselves, there's video of my kids. So we have a lot of voices coming in. It's almost as if the piece is an antenna and it catches all these signals that are in the air, and the audience is able to have this this extraordinary visual and auditory experience as we capture a single life, an epic life, in less than an hour and a half.
So the show is described as you're trying to connect with your father, and we've already touched on these interviews that you've done, these conversations that you've done with him. The gulf between you two, how would you describe that? Was that cultural? Was that his generation, say? Was there a situation that precipitated all of this? Or
it was the gulf between my father and I would attribute to the obvious ones. It was generational. He had me fairly late in life. I was the youngest of five kids. It was cultural. He is so old school Japanese, and I'm a Canadian who grew up on McDonald's and watching TV, drinking Slurpees. It was linguistic. He was way more comfortable in Japanese. My Japanese is horrible. But the thing that kept us really apart, more than anything, was the fact that our personalities were so similar. So as a teenager, the fights between us became very violent, both physically and emotionally. And again, it was because we were so similar. I vowed to be nothing like him, but I ended up in the same profession, working with the same technicians, the same studios. And so, ironically, it was our similarities that kept us apart.
And having done this show now, I mean, it's to start this week, having put it together, the relationship between the two of you now, because he is gone, he is dead, is there peace? Has something been reconciled that needed to be?
You know, people say, oh, your dad will be there in spirit. He'll be there in the front row. He'll be there on stage. And in these final rehearsals towards this opening night, there are times when I'm not a superstitious person, and I don't believe that there is an interventionist God, and I have my doubts if I'd be seriously surprised if anything happens after life. Mm-hmm. I mean, after one dies. But when I close my eyes during the show, there are moments when I see... It's funny, I never told anyone about this, but I see this sky, and I see clouds billowing past, and I have the sensation that my father's in a really interesting place, and I feel that he's inside of me, and I feel a spectrum of feelings and intensities that have just stopped me mid-performance, because I don't know. It's almost as if him inside me, or me playing him, or his memories becoming alive for me, I feel like maybe this, all these hours of interviewing him, maybe it was a kind of osmosis, because in the moment of performance, when I'm summoning him, when I'm playing him, I feel an intensity of feelings and images that I half wonder, maybe this in some way is his final gift to me. So whatever regrets, resentments, anger I may have felt towards him before, yeah, I'm in a different place now. I think I say that, you know, my father never hugged me. He never said, I love you. And for a long time, I guess I was angry because he wasn't like the dads on TV. And so for me, I found him wanting. But when I spent so many hours in his world interviewing him, and I could look around as if I was in his world, I realized you come from a completely different universe. And that helped me let go of, it helped me release him from my expectations, these are the rules for loving me. And once I realized that he showed his own father that he loved him without saying it, yeah, that allowed me to accept him for who he was. And now I have I have no doubt that he loved my whole family, including me, in a very powerful way.
So I think you've alluded to this already, but I've seen you speak on this before about the fact that you're a very different father than he was.
Yeah.
The process of doing Empire of the Sun, the show, has it changed how you are as a father in any way?
Yeah, it has, because doing Empire of the Sun has changed that in the sense that I have a son and a daughter, and my son is 8 years old, and he'll cry with very little prompting. Cries a lot. And as a result, probably prior to doing this show, I may have been guilty of, you know, trying to get him to, hey, man up, suck it up, you know, be a man. Like, quit crying. Is that really worth crying about? Seriously, mm-hmm. Come on. And now I realize, you know, his sensitivity, you know, the world will beat that out of him soon enough. Other people will police his emotions, and childhood lease has all too short a date. So the one thing that I change, I've actually explained to him, Tyler, you know what, you're kind of the hero of this story, because Empire of the Sun is about how Grandpa never cried. So how your great-grandfather never cried. Grandpa never cried. I've never cried. But you're the only Shigematsu male who still, whose heart is still tender enough to feel sadness, and which also means you have that much more capacity to feel joy. So I've explained to my son that, and it's kind of my way of apologizing and not getting into trouble, because I show photos of him crying. It's kind of a funny moment of the story, but yeah. I don't want him to be mad at me. But yeah, for sure. I'm just trying to be a little bit more gender neutral, because of course it's okay for my daughter to cry. Yeah, cry on daddy's shoulder, but I want it to be equally okay for my boy to cry for, you know, until he's, you know, until he's an old man.
Yeah. You've mentioned Richard Wolff, the director of the show.
Yeah.
I've had him on this program a couple of times. It is a one-man show, but there are a lot of people behind the scenes, I guess, along the way for all of this, who've helped you along the way in terms of whether it's the design, because there's a lot of audio and visual as well, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. Richard Wolff is a magician. I consider him to be the only director for this project. About 6 years ago, he took a leap of faith, and it's very rare that you'll find anyone on a stage these days that hasn't been to acting school. And when I presented myself for consideration in front of Richard, he knew I've never been to acting school. I don't have that kind of experience, but he took a gamble on me. He was the first person in this town to risk giving me a role. This represents our fourth collaboration together. And he's an exceptionally collaborative person. And along with Heidi Taylor, who is the dramaturge for this show, and she's also the artistic director for Playwright Theater Center, they helped me wrestle, you know, all these hours worth of material and about 20 hours worth of live performance down to 70 minutes. And they've helped me just connect with the story. They've literally enabled me to take transcripts of my father that read like transcripts and create the conditions that allow my father's spirit to come flooding through, to the point where I see everything he saw during the great fire of Kagoshima, during the aftermath of Hiroshima. So yeah, I feel like you know, my name is on the show, written and performed, but no matter what I can say, I can never overstate their contribution to what the play, what the performance piece has become.
And it must be gratifying for all of you that the show's run sold out and that you've been held over already.
Yeah, that we were stunned. From what I've heard, I've consulted with many theater veterans, including Richard and Heidi, and from what I understand, this is unprecedented. It's completely unheard of for a brand new play from an unknown person, an unknown playwright, to sell out its run even before it opens, and then to have that run extended is, from what I keep hearing, is some kind of history-making. So it is very gratifying. I think part of it might be to do the fact that this story may sound esoteric in the sense that it's about a Japanese-Canadian family that immigrate to Canada, but it's about really fundamental things about life and death, saying goodbye, and about connections and misconnections with parents and with loved ones. And I think just given the few excerpts that I performed for the public, the response has been really overwhelming. And I think because I've been doing a few pieces here and there, I think interest has been building. And when people see this show, Empire of the Sun, the thing that never ceases to amaze me is when they say, my God, Tetsuro, this is exactly my family. That's my dad. The accent is different.
Yeah.
But this is 100% my experience.
Yeah, like a lot of people, I'm looking forward to the show, and so I really enjoyed talking to you today, and break a leg, as they say.
Thank you so much, Joe. What a pleasure it is talking to you.
The website's for more, tickets.theculch.com, and, of course, Tetsuro's own site, shigi.com. Empire of the Sun is written and performed by Tetsuro Shigematsu, who joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planto.